Hey, Startup Hustle listeners, before we get into today's episode, I've got some exciting news to share. If you've enjoyed the insights and stories here at Startup Hustle, you're going to love what we have in store at our brand new podcast called Product Driven. I've always described myself as a product guy first, entrepreneur, software engineer, but really a product guy. I love building products. Many people struggle, though, with how to take a product idea and build a tech product, while software engineers struggle to understand the business side of things and they just don't see the big picture. My new podcast, Product Driven, is about that gap between business and the tech side of building software. It's designed for startup founders, tech leaders, software engineers, and anyone who loves tech and startups. Thank you for being part of this community. Enjoy this episode of Startup Hustle, and please subscribe to Product Driven in your podcast app, and you can also check it out on YouTube. Thank you so much.
And we're back for another episode of Startup Hustle, a podcast for entrepreneurs by entrepreneurs. If you want to start, own, or build a business, then you're in the right place. We bring you the real truth about what it's like to take something from concept to launch. From growth, innovation, experience, failing, or winning big, we've got you covered. So let's get down to business with another episode of Startup Hustle, brought to you by Fullscale.io. And we're back for another episode of Startup Hustle. Matt DeCourcy here to have another conversation I'm hoping helps your business grow. So one, two, three, that's how many different companies I've started. And that makes me at least a second, now a third time founder. But the real question is it easier to do something big, innovative, or awesome when you've maybe done it before? Or do you have to live up to weird expectations? Or I don't know. That's what we're going to talk about during today's episode of Startup Hustle. Before I introduce today's guest, today's episode of Startup Hustle is powered by Fullscale.io. Hiring software developers is difficult, and Fullscale can help you build a software team quickly and affordably. They've also got the platform to help you manage that team. Go to Fullscale.io to learn more. I said we, if you're not aware, Fullscale.io, that's my company, and we love talking to Startup Hustle listeners. So reach out. It only takes like 2 minutes to fill out the hire developers form. See if we can figure out some solutions together. With me today, I have the CEO and co-founder of another one of Kansas City's top startups. That's what we've been highlighting this week. Really excited to continue to highlight my hometown and talk to more innovating people. And in this case, someone who has done it once before as well. With me today, I have Phil Reynolds, the CEO and co-founder of DevStride. You can go to devstride.com. There's a link for that in the show notes. In fact, why don't you go ahead and scroll down and click that now and take a look at what they do. So while you listen to today's episode, you got a little more perspective. Speaking of perspective, let's hear a little bit more from Phil. Phil, welcome to Startup Hustle.
Thanks so much for having me on, and I really appreciate you showcasing DevStride on the list. It's an honor, and we really appreciate it. So, yeah, thanks.
Well deserved, and you are an accomplished founder, and that's part of where our title for today's episode came from. So, why don't we just go ahead and get into a little bit more about your backstory?
Yeah, sure. So, let's see here. Backing up, right out of college, I was a musician actually, and at totally separate background from tech. Hadn't spent a lot of time there, but got a degree in electronic arts and digital media production, which turned out to be really valuable for the rest of my career because I spent a lot of time presenting things to people and trying to, you know, portray my business in a professional light. A lot of things you do here. So I did that for a few years and then realized that being in the arts and in music is kind of like being homeless. It's very similar.
I'm laughing quietly behind the mic because I get it.
Yeah. So, you know, like closing out like my fourth year consecutive of every Saturday night, like shutting down a bar with a guitar. I was like, you know, I should probably do something better with my time. And so I decided to get into software, taught myself to code, and started a company with my cousin at the time, Chris Reynolds, called Brightcore. And at the time it was called Intuitive Web Solutions. And we were just sort of like all entrepreneurs, just trying to figure it out at first, doing projects here and there, landed a whole long, complicated story I won't go into where we landed an opportunity to do a web-based quoting system for an insurance company. And that went well. And it went well enough that their friends started calling us and we started investing in the insurance space and did really well with these quoting systems for a while. And that scaled up until eventually all of our customers asked us to replace their core ERP system. And that's where Brightcore was born. And so my first company was really founded and launched from this like overwhelming market demand in this niche in insurance. From there, that company really scaled up rapidly. And we ended up in a situation where we went from, you know, just the two of us up to just short of 400 employees and a pretty good sized company. Did a Series A, Series B, had 80 enterprise customers, 43 product teams. It was big and it did a lot. It was a lot of fun. I learned a lot. I made more mistakes than I care to count. and as does everyone, of course. But definitely a lot of battle scars and a lot of lessons learned. And one of the things that I learned in that process was after you bring in a Series B sort of private equity capital partner, the nature of your business changes quite a bit. And if you're got the startup entrepreneur DNA, there comes a point in time where the scaling mechanics of the business and what's necessary to run the business isn't as fun to you anymore. And so I exited the company, spent a little bit of time off. I went and lived at a beach in Costa Rica for a bit, and it was a lot of fun. And then got to thinking, you know, if it's in your blood, if you're born a startup entrepreneur, you just can't help it. And I just like every night I would dream about things I could do.
It doesn't wash off.
No, it doesn't at all. It's like a disease. I don't know. It's a disease. It's the best way I can describe.
That's probably a fair way to put it, honestly, because it does feel that way. Yeah. You're like, why? Yeah. Why was I made this way? I should be able to relax and stay on the beach.
Yeah. I mean, literally, you'll be like 7 nights into 3 nights, you know, 3 hours of sleep a night, and your brain won't stop spinning on some stupid problem that you need. But if it's in your blood, it's in your blood.
Well, by the way, on that, so do you have sleepless problems?
Oh,
very well known in the organization. Like, I don't want to be that way, man.
Oh,
it's like I would prefer to be a little more peaceful in my mind. So people are like, what's that like to like have all these ideas and energy? I'm like, okay, so if you put a bunch of bottle caps and a blender and turn it on high, that's what it sounds like.
Yes. Yeah. I tell people all the time, it's a little bit like imagine like people running by in your head with sparklers all the time.
Sparkle. Well, like the kind of firecrackers. Anyway, sorry.
But here's the thing.
You're feeling restless.
Yeah, I'm feeling restless.
Wait, you exited that company and then went to the beach.
Yeah. So it's an interesting story. I make a lot of mistakes. One of the things I tend to do well is I tend to be pretty strategic about the decisions that I make as an executive leader. And so before we ever decided to raise capital in a Series A or a Series B, we decided that we really wanted to make sure we did secondary in each of those rounds. And that's advice I would give any founder. If you're doing a structured, formal round, always structure secondary capital into it. Because every time there's a change of control in your company, the nature of the business is going to change. The nature of your job is going to change. So you should take some chips off the table so you have a backup plan. And so we should
describe that a little bit more. Yeah. And people will refer to that a bunch of different ways. Sometimes they'll say clawing a little back, but if you're as you move forward in these rounds and you're kind of selling a little bit of your control out of the way, as a founder, it's advisable to not just be in this. Well, part of where people get stressed for startups is because the founder life where you don't get paid shit. And you don't have any money. That gets old in a hurry.
It really does.
And the thing is people are like, dude, your company's worth a gazillion dollars. And you're like, that's amazing. Cause I've got like $13,000, you know? And But part of it
is monopoly money,
but it gets harder to take that money out when other people have to make the decision about it.
Yep.
And so part of that is when other people have some kind of control or something to say about your path, who knows where that's going to go? So take care of yourself, take care of your family. If you've built something that's bigger than you, it'll probably end up being okay in the end, but that's okay to do.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. And I like advice I would give to anybody whose business is succeeding and scaling is, especially if you're the founder, especially you ought to be having talks with capital partners on a regular basis. If, if you're ever planning to raise, there's lifestyle businesses.
Even if you aren't.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
Agreed. You learn a lot. Why not? Because a lot of those people are really sophisticated and will give you good input about your own business.
Yeah. I agree with that a lot. I agree with that a lot. So I always built it into my calendar. So, again, I'll get to DevShine in just a second.
Well, I was going
to
say, we're just in the conversation.
No, it's great.
It's happening, people. It's happening.
Yeah, well, I think the history really leads up to why I'm doing what I'm doing now at DevStride, because I think DevStride is a fascinating opportunity in the world. I'll get to that in a second. The thing that I learned from running a really large scaling software team, company grew quite large, 43 product teams, 88 enterprise customers. And every one of those product teams has a roadmap that they're trying to manage, right? That capabilities are trying to deliver to market, release over release. And we're doing that in service of all these enterprise customers. We're bringing on, 5 to 10 enterprise customers in a year, big implementations, multi-year implementations. And as we're doing that, you can imagine the complexity of those roadmaps and of all the dependencies that follow all of that. And so ultimately, what really exhausted me about my last company was trying to keep the sparklers in the head problem. I can't let go of the details. So I know what every product team's working on. I know what every customer has asked for. I've got thousands of details in my head.
But you can't be the conduit for all of it.
No, of course
not. It burns you out. It's a circuit board with too much shit flowing through it.
Absolutely.
And it really will. It's going to burn out the circuits.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and you're a constraint. Yeah, you're a constraint in the organization.
A lot of times as founders, we want to, you talk about, being a second time founder and, what do you learn down the road? Well, first off, I did the conduit thing. It's very easy because you're trying to do so many different things as a founder, so many different ways. Some of them you're sitting on the toilet watching a YouTube video, trying to figure out something you need to do in 15 minutes and sound credible while you're given the details of it.
Yep.
And you're like, oh my God. And that's really a real, and maybe a little too realistic of a picture, but it's true.
Yeah.
And and what happens is by nature is because you don't have the people or sometimes the path or a moment to feel like you can rest is that you position yourself to do too many things. And then unfortunately what you run into is an organization that's too dependent on you being the conduit. And that is a path for, I'd say that's something I've really learned over time is to try to get away from that. And that for me is almost as frustrating as doing it all myself, but eventually you have to grow up. You mentioned 400 employees. We have 300 at full scale, which, the funny thing is the United States government says that's still a small business.
Hilarious.
Anything under 500 people.
Tony, does it feel small to you to run it?
No. Oh my God. I talk to people all the time. They're like, what?
Yeah.
That's a huge company. Well, apparently it's not. Apparently that is a small business.
Right.
There's nothing small about that.
No.
I mean,
it's so much that you're managing.
Honestly, when you get past about 20 people, it's a lot.
Yeah. Really, almost every time the staff, does something like doubling, the whole nature of how you manage the business changes. Mm-hmm. It has to. And to your point, building systems that don't depend on you as an exceptional outperforming founder is hard.
Yep.
It's hard. So I was always frustrated by the amount of dependency that would end up back on either me or a couple of other key performers. And we tried to use every project management suite there was. We used Jira, which I imagine most people listening to this podcast use Jira on some
really
level.
Common. Yeah.
Monday ClickUp, Asana, there's a bunch of them. What drove me crazy about every one of them is that if you're thinking in terms of one individual project and you go into one project, look at the team on that one project, the goals of that one project, those systems work. They're awesome. But the moment you're responsible for execution and planning and strategy and performance across a bunch of projects at once, and especially if all those projects have to coordinate, like in my case, it was like 43 product teams implementing for one big enterprise customer. Those tools fall over and you find yourself doing 1,000 manual things, putting out fires everywhere, and it's just awful. So when I retired from Brightcore for a second, went and lived on the beach and couldn't stop thinking all the time, all I could think about was how impossible and how intractable that problem had been for the last 20 years of my life. and it drove me nuts. I mean, I laid awake at night. I started drawing, you know, screen designs and data flow diagrams and all this stuff. My wife was finally like, we should probably do something about this.
She probably wanted to get you out of her hair, man. Yeah. I wonder, that's a two-edged sword. It's like, my wife's like the same way. It's like, you need something to keep you busy. And then it's like, hey, you know, we're over here now. You know, it's like, I don't know.
That's, well, so I'll give you a detail on my wife too in a second. So we work together and always in half for the last 12 years we've worked together. So she was my CMO at Brightcore, CMO again at DevStride, but we have a very different approach to work. And I tend to be more the sparklers in the head, million ideas, just run at the thing. I'm in a room like, why is this broken? You know? And she's this amazing operations person. She's very methodical, very process oriented. And the two of us together actually make a good team.
My wife worked at the business that I wrote about in Million Dollar Bedroom. And she was basically our coordinator manager. Yeah. Like she's got a level of
detail and organization.
And, yo, God.
I'm pointing at him across the desk.
Yeah. Right. Well, it's true. So, but and that's tough to do. I mean, on a lot of ways. And, you know, I did mention in that same book, I actually recommend that you don't work with your family and friends if you plan on keeping them as your friends. But it's tough. And I've had so many people say to me, I'm sure you got this, you've heard a bunch of like, they're like, how do you work with your wife? We would kill each other. Okay. Well then don't work with your husband or your wife.
Yeah.
Like it's that simple. If that's the case, then don't do it.
Yeah. And it's hard. Even if you, like, we're very practiced at it. And even then it's hard because I think one of the things that's really difficult is if you're an entrepreneur, everybody who's listening to this podcast and is an entrepreneur, you know, you never sleep. You never stop thinking about your business. You never stop thinking about whatever core problems you're trying to solve.
Sounds like a great thing to sign up for, right,
people? Right, yeah. And also, by the way, you turn Monopoly money for a very long time.
You basically just described what I think you would describe a crazy person.
Yeah, more or less.
I mean, but
entrepreneurism is a form of insanity, right? So,
hopefully not.
Yeah. I mean, I actually went crazier
when you weren't doing entrepreneur stuff.
That's true. And I actually haven't believed.
Are you dead though? You dead, right?
Yeah. I mean, I couldn't. Like I said, it's just part of my DNA. Yeah. Have you ever read the book The Rational Optimist before?
I have not.
It's a really good book. It's all about. It's on the Gates reading list a few years ago, and I picked it up and read. It's great, and it was all about how entrepreneurial activity and sort of the general drive toward a capitalist ideal. Which, of course, there's a lot of problems with capitalism, too, that we could go on and on about. But generally, that has produced the greatest amount of overall enduring good in the world.
Yeah.
And so I just did
an episode, and I don't like to discuss dates because this is going to come out a month after we recorded. But I had a professor from Princeton on that was a professor in Oxford. Yeah. Well, so you heard him talking about that. But like, man, like, so there's Professor Derek Leto is titled The History of Entrepreneurship. And I mean, he really made a remarkably compelling case for the fact that capitalism has propelled the most meaningful and innovative and important changes in the history of the world.
It's the tide lifting all the boats.
Look, I have goosebumps talking about it. Really do. I mean, that's like, okay. And if you got goosebumps thinking about that, you're probably good to be an entrepreneur. If you didn't, maybe don't.
So in a minute, I'll circle back around to some of the, if you remind me, I'll circle back around to some of the really cool personal stories I have on that front. I agree. It really is that way.
By the way, The Rational Optimist, How Prosperity Evolves is a book by Matt Ridley.
Yes, it is. Yeah. And it really is excellent. I would highly recommend it. Okay. So sitting on the beach in Costa Rica, drawing 1,000, screen flows and everything. A couple of engineers that had worked with me at Brightcore had been thinking about the same problem for a long time. And some of my good friends, some of the smartest people I've ever met in my life. And so a group of us just kind of put our heads together and started thinking about how you could reimagine thinking about work and work management and sequencing, you know, work in the kind of software teams we had spent our lives working in. And we went out and we started writing code. And not too long afterwards, again, because I did secondary capital, the Series A, Series B, had cash in the bank, I was able to do an angel round for the company. Funded the first 18 months of operations, and my wife and I just kind of worked the company for free, as most founders do, helped, you know, cover expenses for our other two founders. We got all the way to an initial go-to-market offering very early, but an initial go-to-market offering. And then about 6 months ago, I set out to start raising a pre-seed round.
Which went well.
Yeah, it went well. And many thanks to Flyover Capital here in Kansas City. They led our round. And then a group of privates and strategics and people that I know in the world followed on as well. And yes, we were able to pull together $3.3 million on a pre-seed round, and that was great. And so that funded some initial scale-up activities, early go-to-market, which is right where we are now. That all closed just a few months ago. And so now I'm back in the seat of
welcome back. Welcome back. Congratulations, and I'm sorry.
Yeah. Thank you.
Both are a very fair response to that. Now,
celebration and condolences.
I want to pause for a second. First off, I got something that I think all of you listen, especially in smaller markets, need to hear. Now, before I do that, a quick reminder that today's episode of Startup Hustle is brought to you by Fullscale.io. And that's because finding expert software developers doesn't have to be difficult. Look, you can come to our platform. It takes like 2 minutes to define your needs, and it will match you up with highly vetted, experienced people that are going to help you solve problems and work only for you. It's that simple. Just go to fullscale.io. Now, the thing that I want to bring up here, okay, pre-seed round, $3.3 million, and you did it in Kansas City.
Yeah.
Okay, so Kansas City, there's only like 8 to 10 huge markets, and then the rest of us are kind of like from Kansas City. Right. We're from some mid-market that probably has that has like the Kansas City Royals that are good like every 30 years. We get the Chiefs. We're spoiled with the Chiefs.
Yeah, we are.
But with that, you know, and you're complaining that you can't raise money in your town, there's no pre-seed capital, blah, blah, blah. It's not true.
No, it's not true.
You got to create something that has value. You got to have a plan with it. Now, with that, I think it's probably fair to say that it was probably easier as a second-time founder.
Most certainly. So my previous seed capital partners all had a 26x exit opportunity in my Series B. That helps.
Right. So in fairness to my comment, yes, that helps. But the thing that founders and entrepreneurs make a mistake of is okay, the product and the company's great, but those people are investing in you, Phil.
Right.
Because you and your team.
Oh, yeah.
And these are proven people that have proven results. And you need to get out. You need to understand that, people, that especially in the pre-seed round, they're betting on the jockey, not the horse. So you got to sell you, your team, your expertise, whatever it is, your passion, your vision, and make it a big vision, because you're not going to get a huge amount of cash or anything if you're like, well, I'm thinking about, I need like 50 grand to build my MVP. Fuck it. I need $3.3 million because this is
it. We're going to go crush it.
And that's it.
Yeah.
Right. But can you validate that you got a lot more investor attention because you had a bigger vision?
Yeah. So I can talk about that a lot. One of the things that I've tried to do since I landed in Kansas City is I've tried to be helpful to other founders in town.
Thank you.
And And thanks to you. Thank you. Obviously, you're doing more than anybody here. Yeah. And I really, really, have enjoyed that. And to your point, there is a founder, I won't talk about the company necessarily, because I'm not sure if he wants me to share it all publicly, but, he was struggling to raise, money, and, I went and visited with him, and I did not go out and do the pitch for him. I didn't raise for him. I just sat down and I looked at his pitch deck, and I had him talk to me for, give me the pitch. And at the end, I was like, this is shit. This is terrible. Like, you're doing this all wrong. And so
it sounds like something I'd say to someone, and I do it. I do it because I love you, not because.
Yeah. Same.
You. Yeah.
Well, it worked out. So
you don't get that enough with people though, man. Like sometimes you get it. Look, if it sucks, tell someone.
The last thing I want to hear on a sales demo.
Constructively.
Yes.
But still.
The last thing I want to hear on a sales demo, the last thing I want to hear on pitch feedback is great job. That's the last thing, because what do I do with great job?
Yeah.
All I do with great job is, okay, do what I did last time. That doesn't tell me anything. Yeah. I want you to, I don't care if it's huge, if it's microscopic, drill in on where I effed up in this, because I want to get better. Every second of my life, I want to get better at what I'm doing. And then that's how over time, you know, you gain those advantages. So my friend.
Can I have a couple guesses about what all right, I want you to real quick, think about three things that sucked. And I'm going to take a couple guesses and you can tell me if I get one of them. These are top three things that sucked.
Okay.
It was too long.
Absolutely too long.
Okay.
And in the wrong places.
Right. Right. Okay. If when talking about what the business did, it talked all about the features and maybe not the benefits of what it did for the people.
All product and feature, all capabilities.
Am I two about for two? Who,
yep.
Okay. Course. And third, it did a really poor job of explaining to the investor how they were going to either get their money back or benefit.
Totally missing.
Yeah.
No. There's
was
so
I,
many.
Did I get them?
You nailed it.
Was that the three?
Of course. You've seen these before too, right?
There's nothing supernatural about that. That's the problem with everyone's pitch deck or pitch.
We all fall in love with our idea and we think our idea is the thing that matters. Yeah. And I've heard you say this before on the podcast here. So I know you think this, there is a, I couldn't agree more.
Was I really three for three? Yeah. Was there something
else? No, you really were.
I felt like that's almost it every time.
Yeah, that's it every time. It's people talking about their idea and talking about and being so focused on what they're going to go do. Don't forget the people who are handing you money. So sorry, I'm getting a little bit ahead of myself. After I exited my position at Brightcore, I had quite a bit of money and I turned around and became an LP in a bunch of funds. So one of the things I can appreciate about going to raise money is I am frequently the person on the other side of the table investing in startups.
Yep. Done it.
Yeah. So done I know what it feels like to be in that chair. And I know my job in that pitch is to convince this person that this is the right use of their funds where they're going to get the greatest maximum return. That is all they care about.
Yeah.
They don't give a shit about your idea. They don't give a shit about the company that you're, I mean, they do, but really what they're there to do is they're there to deliver returns in their fund or for their own personal portfolio. So you need to make that case.
It's capitalism.
Yeah, right. That's why we're all here.
Yeah, so, I mean, and that's just a fair way to say it.
Otherwise, you could apply for a government grant.
Right. And if you're, if you find a fund that isn't focused on that, don't put your money in a different fund, right? Yeah. That's the whole. Now, on the flip side of that, actually, I'm going to back that up a little bit because I have actually put money into things that are not pure capitalism because I think it is important if you have the resources to support things that are on the social side like Lauren hosts a regular show here. I've been a big financial supporter of that because I believe in Lauren. Some of that it doesn't always have to be but I will say she is focused on helping entrepreneurs, it is still by transit or whatever the fuck but it makes sense, but you can still find ways to do that.
Absolutely.
All right.
Yeah. So I really think that when you, so to wrap my story up, my friend had been trying to raise, couldn't raise. I helped him refine his pitch and he went out and raised $1.8 million the next week. Yeah. And I did not help. All I did was refine what he was still presenting himself because he's amazing. His business idea is amazing. Everything he's doing is amazing. He just wasn't packaging it up in a way that helped an investor recognize here's a mature, successful founder that's going to go crush it. And so he needed to deliver that message. And once he did,
I just did something similar.
Yeah.
And it was a company that I had invested in that has actually grown to make the list of our top Kansas City startups.
Congratulations.
That will be fair. And it's not just because we invested in it, but yeah, we'll tell that story on another episode. But a lot of it was, I mean, it's amazing what you can accomplish in 2 minutes. So maybe you shouldn't talk more than that for your pitch. So what's really interesting is I you talk about the second time founder or whatever. Now, so I haven't ever needed to bring in outside capital. The only time I've ever had a quote investor is Watson, who we own Full Scale together.
Right.
So, and that wasn't really the same thing. Now, some of that's just been my own choice because honestly, I'm maybe better off to not have a bunch of people telling me what to do.
It's a big shift,
but I've been involved in a ton of it and on the check side, the check writing side and so much of it. And you talk like my evolution and what and how and the presentation should occur is just, it literally exponentially has gotten shorter and shorter and shorter and shorter and shorter. Right. Like no one wants your 60-page business plan as an introduction. Make a cool one pager. You don't end the deal in the email. Want that person to talk to you, like make it, if you are running the risk, if everyone's trying to, hey, how much text, image, charts, graphs, crap can we get on this slide? Maybe have less.
Yes. I mean, I think so. I told you I started out in the arts. So I was music and design.
What do you play?
So, well, I play a lot. I was a piano major in college for a year.
Perfect run up to entrepreneurship.
Yes, right? Exactly. Yeah, exactly.
Totally.
You know, actually, it's interesting. I
actually could make a case for the fact that
musician, engineer, there's a lot of correlation.
Well, no, I think it's on many levels. It's one of those things that requires practice and consistency, and also a lot of showing up and doing it. Those things on the days that you might not particularly be feeling it.
Oh yeah. Well, so if you think about, you know, leading as a CEO or being an entrepreneur, running a pitch deck. So in my previous job, I stood up and I present. I was a keynote speaker at a big annual conference all the time. And that's very much standing up and delivering a presentation like that is no different than practicing a song on my guitar and standing up and playing it. I mean, it's the same thing.
The importance of reps. And, as a hobby, it's just to give you an idea of what my hobbies are like. Over the last year, I've really been spending a fair amount of time studying the traits of genius.
That's cool.
And with that, and I worked in the music industry as well. I know some very interesting people that have some that, by the way, seem to be more fascinated with me than them, which has been an interesting dynamic that I've gone through over like 10 years. Because at first I was like, dude, then they call me for advice. I'm like, okay. Oh. But the thing I learned is you can have all the talent in the world, but if you don't have the discipline to sit down and polish it, you're just going to be kind of talented person. Yeah. So if you really like the people that do even a genius, and this is a very misunderstood thing because people look at a talented person and they're like, that guy's a genius. That lady's a genius. But a talented person can hit the target that everybody sees, and a genius hits the target no one even knew was there. And so with that, though, they go through this. And by the way, part of this is, I'm not saying I'm a genius, but part of it is trying to understand maybe on some levels, like what's wrong. Why was I made this way?
Yeah.
Because if you have the bottle caps in the blender kind of feel, like the sparklers and all that, if you really do experience in that, then you do get to step into that every now and then. I get into some weird supernatural states.
Yeah, you get into sort of a flow where really it's crazy feeling it.
But it's hard to reproduce. So I've really been fascinated with musicians because world-class guitarist has to get on stage. I like jam bands, so that it's not the same 4 minute and 4 second song. Those guys have to get up there and kind of improv it. And if they mess up in front of 9,000 people or however many, then they have to deal with all the chat room and all the hate online afterward. Yeah. I can't believe that guy ruined my show. He missed one note. I'm like, really? Is that what ruined your night?
Yeah, you played like 4 million great notes.
Let's focus on those. But how do you get around it and stay with that? And by the way, there's one thing, and I like sharing this because I think the thing that I've learned from that, you talk about the experience or some people, I say I'm getting old on some days, but I'm actually just gained a lot of experience. But the two things that hamper and restrain genius is self-doubt and negativity. So self-doubt can even be you saying negative things because that's you expressing self-doubt.
Imposter syndrome follows so many people.
And then the negativity is people around you. So so for your first business, did someone along the way, I guarantee you it happened, say, there's no way this is going to work.
Oh, of course. Like
a bunch of people.
Yeah, of course.
Never going to pull this off. Yes. You're blah, 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 blah.
So at the time I was going head to head, and I am even more so in my new business. I'm going head to head against, 900 pound gorillas in the industry. It's not like Jira's like a startup and I'm going up against Atlassian. They're a big company. I think there's some major flaws in their product design. I think they have massive respect for what they've done. Obviously they're tremendously successful and done enormous good, but also there's holes in their design. I think there's always going to be people telling you what you're trying to do is too ambitious, too hard, too difficult, too expensive, whatever. And if you let that voice guide you, then you'll never do anything because there's always a reason you can't do something. And I think the mark of a good entrepreneur is somebody who just says, I'm just going to do it anyway. And the difference, I think, between successful entrepreneurs and those who don't, because I think pretty much the I'm going to do it anyway kind of makes you an entrepreneur. There's a lot of failed entrepreneurs. Probably the majority of entrepreneurs are failed entrepreneurs. I think the difference between those that are good and those that aren't ain't the good ones. While they are convinced that the direction they want to go is valid and viable, and they have their own conviction about that, they're also sober about the world around them and about the realities they see playing out.
Yeah, yeah,
and
yeah.
You have to learn to look at when like your shit stinks too. And so, so you got to look at your own ideas and say, I thought this was a great idea, but this is wrong. This is wrong. It's just, I mean, going back to the music analogy, like, it's not like the first time you play a ripping guitar solo, you nail it. It takes a lot of practice.
That's why most people quit a musical instrument, because they're not good at it right away. Like, dude, no one was.
You got to keep it up.
No one. Dave Matthews did not pick up a guitar and kill it on day one.
No.
Like, that's not how it works.
Now, Carter Buford maybe did. I don't
know.
Carter Buford, he's a drummer.
He's
insane. But anyway,
that guy is a machine.
Yeah, he really is. He's incredible. I digress. The there really is a lot to having your own conviction, running towards your dream, but then also being recognizing that whatever you come up with out of the gate is almost surely wrong, unless you're just very lucky.
Well, you will figure it out as you go. The reality is you're going to end up throwing away all of your original code.
Oh, yeah.
100%.
Yeah. Oh,
like,
yeah.
Well, that MVP that you're like, oh, we built it. Yeah. It's going to go in the trash at some point. Because there's a better way. You don't know what you don't know.
Yeah, yeah. And you don't know what you don't know about your market. And so, I've experienced this so many times in my career where I think I have a great idea. All the swans are white until I run into the black swan. Now I've got a customer that does something I never envisioned. My data model is completely wrong, or my workflow is wrong, whatever. And so, I mean, experience helps in the sense that you start to recognize patterns where someone says something overly simplistic or overly specific to their business, and you recognize that's specific and there's a generalization here.
And I call those echoes.
Yep.
Yeah, so echoes come in a number of different ways. And sometimes with Full Scale, Matt and I didn't start Full Scale intentionally. He invested in Gigabook. We were going to help him build a dev team.
Yep.
We're going to mark it up a little bit. Gigabook have a burn rate, and then we just kept hearing the echo of people saying, what do we need to do? Or what do I need to do to get some people over in your office in the Philippines? Cause I can't find what I need here.
Yeah.
And a good entrepreneur recognizes something like that and realizes there's a problem needed to be solved. And then we went beta client one, beta client two, beta client three. And we realized, okay, this is something we can do. But we went into it saying, and both of us were second time founders at that point already, and said, okay, we're only going to do this if we can provide a world, if we feel that we are going to rapidly progress to the point where we can, and not even immediately, but everyone would like to provide world-class value on day one, but you got to learn a lot of stuff.
You do. You do.
If you think your brand new business is already brilliant, you're wrong. Or you're stubborn or whatever.
Well, it's kind of your point about the capital partners investing in you, the founder. What they're really investing is
your ability to figure it out.
Yes. You're going to go in there. You're going to talk to the customers.
Yes.
And so with DevStride, I'm experiencing this all over again. And it's both exhilarating, terrifying, all those things at once, right? It's all the things.
That's why I said congrats.
Yeah.
And I'm sorry. Yeah.
And I love it. I love it. And so we had this idea for what we thought a project and portfolio management system should look like for a software team. But now we've got it in the hands of some real power users. And we're seeing a lot of
they tell you something different.
Oh my God. What was so cool is, and I would recommend this for any founder too, especially when somebody going into like an enterprise software space. We pulled together just a killer group of strategic advisors, which are sort of early adopters and customers and experts and people like that in the field. And we do a monthly call with several groups of them where we spend 2 hours and we walk them through everything we did and we ask them for their feedback and their ideas and tell them all the things we're about to go do and ask for all that. I'm amazed that I feel like I am one of the more qualified experts on this topic that there are. And I can talk about all the different project management frameworks. I can talk about all the processes, what's good and bad in an engineering team, why you shouldn't measure lines of code as productivity. I can talk about all these things really well and have lived them all. I still get on a strategic advisor call every week and somebody tells me something I never considered.
Well, that happens to me almost every time I record this podcast. Yeah. That's part of why I do it.
Oh, that's got to be so much fun.
I mean, well, it is. And it's also why we have the format that we have. And you can confirm. I literally tell a guest before we hit record, this is not an interview. This is a conversation.
Yeah.
We're going to talk about a bunch of stuff. It might go one direction. It might go another. Yeah. We'll figure it out along the way. But that's the value that, I mean, so I dropped out of 5 colleges, but I may have graduated from Startup Hustle University at this point. Because like, honestly, I mean, it's at the point that you got to do things for, you know, thousands of hours before you get into it. And, you know, I want to go back to the black swan comment and realizing that maybe your idea isn't as great as you think it is, or maybe it's not going to gain the traction that you hoped it would, or that there's some real flaws in whatever it is. Okay, so founders that fail, ignore all that and just keep plowing forward. And that is the equivalent of like you and I in a boat, and I'm like, dude, we're going really fast, and there is a giant rock or an island right there. And we see it, and we're like, yeah, but you know what? I bet if we go faster or just ignore the rocks and the island, we'll be all right. And that's not the way it works.
No. Yeah. Like you can never, you should never, ever. And this is a real balance, and you have to be careful who you can give this advice to, because some people are so racked with self-doubt.
Yeah.
You have to be careful how much, you know, because they're already doubting themselves to begin with.
Well, just because you get one point of feedback doesn't mean you need to hurry up and change the business.
I tend to be the opposite.
But when you start hearing the echo. When you start hearing the echo,
you need to pay
listen
attention.
To your users, listen to your investors, listen to the, and by the way, if you're outside of those two, well, other than your people, your employees. Outside of that, I might not care as much about what you're saying.
Right.
Because like, so the people that matter, okay, if you lose your users and you lose your employees, then you're going to have a really hard time running a business that's bigger than just you.
Yeah. Oh yeah. I mean, I can't tell you how many times I have told a founder, look, your business is not your code. Like your code is honestly, I know you don't think this, and I'm a computer scientist. For all the computer scientists listening, your code can be replaced. It really can.
Yeah.
And what can't be replaced is the engine that produced the code, the engine that produced the culture, the engine that went out and found the customer, built the relationship, you know,
well, all of critical, that. And the critical thinking that existed that spotted a problem we're solving.
Yes. That's right.
I mean, that's a big...
That's the critical thinking to innovate around it.
Here's the thing. And once again, I hope you went to devstride.com. There's a link in the show notes for that. But if you just do the exact same thing that Jira and Atlassian do, you don't stand a chance.
No.
I mean, unless you're...
Jira better than Jira.
But this is my point.
Yeah.
You know, it's like in... You know, I mean, that's the thing. You got to figure out there's... But with that, the advantage you have... All right. So I often compare this to the game Battleship. What's the hardest boat to sink, man? That little two peg sucker that like you can spend all day. Because the big companies, when they have to make a change or make a move, it's like doing a U-turn. It's like turning around a battleship inside a swimming pool.
So I'll give you an anecdotal.
Well, you can outmaneuver them. You can do something different, and you can find those couple little things. And look, Matt DeCourcy's rule one of building software is this annoying? And if the answer is anything other than no, go back and fix it. Cause you could, you could have this like brilliant product that 99% kills it, but you will remember the one little annoying thing. And on many days that'll make you literally stop using it.
Oh yeah, absolutely. It's true. User UX is.
So sometimes so that one little thing can be what.
Well, I think there's another good book on the thing you just said, called The Innovator's Dilemma. Have you ever read it before, Clayton Christensen?
Awesome. Sounding like a non-read.
Oh no, you're just talking about things I happened to read something about.
So I have, to give you some perspective, I buy the books that, and by the way, The Innovator's Dilemma is by Clayton Christensen. I buy all of my guests that have been authors. I have their books, and I have a bunch of other books. And I honestly haven't read any of them.
I'm too busy doing
my own story.
Yeah, I know.
Like Audible the only time I stand a chance on some of that is on that long plane ride to the Philippines.
Yeah.
And I'm usually just trying to fall asleep on that. So it's,
I'm a member of some service. I can't remember what it's called. I should be able to remember right now. It'd be a good shout out to them. But there's a service I subscribe to that where you can type in any book and it gives you like 20 minutes.
It's a little app. I had that for a while and I wasn't even doing that.
Yeah. Okay. So the innovator's dilemma, it describes the exact problem you're talking about and describes why. And why it is that as companies become larger and more sophisticated, they inherently become more
less innovative.
Less innovative and therefore more ripe for disruption. And my anecdotal story on this for my business is that at my former company, Brightcore, again, big company, a lot of team members, we were an Atlassian shop and we had Jira. And there was a point in time as a CEO where I had two full-time Jira admins just keeping track of permissions and boards and users and all this.
That's
bullshit.
Like Salesforce. It's like Salesforce. Same thing.
We tried to implement Salesforce and had to shut it
down.
Dude,
why is it so complex, man?
God, it's horrible.
I'm trying to simplify the sales process, not customize your shit.
I hear it on how much I hate Salesforce for a long time.
Dude. I mean, for real. I'll take Trello for free. Yeah. And do more with it than I mess with Salesforce.
Yes.
By the way, I want to point out user interface problems. So when I Googled the innovator's dilemma, I ended up, and by the way, this is not a plug for you, Chegg.com, because it says here that I can buy the book for $11.99 or I can rent it for $11.99. And then it has, look, it's right there. It says best value is highlighted that I should rent the book for the same price I
could
just
own
it for.
That is hilarious.
That is a great example of losing your credibility due to a bad user interface. Do better, Chegg.
Come on, Chegg, get with it.
Yeah.
So, okay. So,
sorry, that was bad.
So I had two full-time Jira admins. Then all these projects were running in parallel and I had to go to my board. My last round at Brightcore, I raised about $60 million for the business. And of course, my investors, again, they're investing to get a return. They want a return on that money. So now I have to go out and activate these 43 teams to go build all this shit for my customers. And I go to start asking my product organization for reports. And they're like, well, I don't know. It doesn't give us that. And I'm like wait, you're telling me I'm spending $250,000 a year in software licenses. I've got two full-time salaries admining this thing. Like, yeah, we're going to need an ETL team to go pull all this out and generate these reports. So then we had to hire a couple of data engineers. And basically
you're spending $500,000
a year to get one fucking report for my board. It's terrible. And so I was like, this is dumb. And it is dumb. And it's dumb because, and again, this is not Atlassian's fault. Atlassian, brilliant company, has done an amazing job with a lot of stuff. They have fallen into the exact same cycle that every business, including me at DevStride, will fall into when I'm successful and I get bigger. We will fall into the same trap, most likely, which is you'll end up with bigger and bigger and more sophisticated customers. And those big, sophisticated customers ask for more and more and more features that are very specific to their enterprise. And it just makes the system untenable and unwieldy for everybody else.
Well,
and
that's where you get into Salesforce. Yep. And you know, while I'm in Kansas City, I used to live in Indianapolis. That's where I met my wife. That's where the $1 million bedroom was. But that's where Salesforce has a tower there. And you know, and like,
yes,
and that's
do.
The thing. Like, you have your own high rise and it's the biggest building in the city and all that. And you know, it's just like, but that's the thing. That's the whole point is there's just like this, like, I mean, I open up Salesforce and I'm like, what the fuck? Like, how do I do this?
Do you know that in Salesforce, if you turn a lead into
I spent 10 minutes in that thing and I was like, no,
the data model is incoherent.
No,
it really is.
No.
It's just rough. But anyway, so I believe there's a ton of opportunity for entrepreneurs in many, many enterprise software segments where there's some established leader that's been out there for 20 years, 30 years doing their thing. And they have created so much feature bloat, and or even worse, they've been acquired two or three times by a private equity firm and maybe gobbled up by a bigger private equity firm. And now everything's running on margin and there's 45 million features and the licensing fees are absurd and it's overweight and it's horrible to use and it's slow as shit. And all you want is something that does the thing you need it to do. So my whole career has been going in and looking at verticals. In this case, in DevStride's universe, agile software teams. What does an agile software team need? What do they need the system to do? Let's go have it do that and only that and exactly that. And let's do that. And I'm not trying to be a system for, you know, manufacturing or for travel companies. Like it is project portfolio management specifically for agile software teams. And so we just make all these decisions and all these workflows are just baked right in. So there's no admin. There's no like huge permissioning schemes and all to make it all function. You can set the thing up in a couple of hours and everyone I show it to is like, oh my God, I love this. But of course, over time, the call of the bigger customer and the more features will always come from me too. And eventually you'll need to show investor return and all those things. And so there's a real challenge for entrepreneurs in figuring out, how do I build something compelling, lightweight, nimble, that then doesn't suck later? Yeah. How does 10 years from now me not suck?
Well, I mean, I think you got a lot of good points and you'd probably go for another hour on that. You know, I mean, I don't know, man. I got to say, like, as we kind of wind down the episode and I look at, you know, I, much like I mentioned brevity with the pitch deck, like, I mean, man, I'm really just trying to simplify things. I want to take steps out of like everything I do. Anytime, every time, how can I reduce the number of steps? How can I don't know, man.
Clarity. Less
explanation, because you know, they're one of the simplest ways to compare the complexity of what you're doing. There's just this simple formula. I've talked about it a lot. You take the number of steps, you multiply it times yourself, that's your score. So let's start with six is an easy, 6 times 6, 36. Okay, 3 times 3 is 9. It's actually 4 times harder to implement a 6-step process, and you have 4 times less likelihood of getting people to actually do it or complete it. And that's 3 steps. Like, but that's a big difference in results. And that's how important simplicity is.
My pitch.
So what about a 2-step process?
Yeah, right.
All right. So now that's 9 times harder. Yep. 9 times harder for just a few more steps. And you get back into that, like back to the pitch deck all of it, like the more you give people to think about. And the thing that blows my mind and frustrates me on a remarkable number of days is just how bad people are following instructions.
Oh yeah. I mean, you want to automate.
So there's a reason that Amazon has rapidly moved to a world where you can just click one button and it comes to your door.
Yeah. We're all overloaded, man. Like we're hit by our phones and by every, you know, ad rolls following us around in every social platform. And I mean, like we're all overloaded, and it's true. On the risk thing in our, in my DevStride pitch deck, one of the big money slides in there was I show the aggregate probability of success and how it diminishes. If in each handoff step, you only have a 2% risk.
It's a similar thing. Yeah. I mean, it's a similar thing.
You do it over like 10 steps.
I'm not going to get into the scientific accuracy, because honestly, I will say that it's kind of like the Pareto principle, the 80-20 rule. I can probably shape that to be about however I want you to
push
hear it.
Yeah, right. Nudge it around.
But as a general metric, I mean, that is it. I find that what I described in the with the steps and all that really is true, like in so many things in life. Yeah. And it's like, I don't know, man. I just try to, I think if you, so I mentioned rule one. So, is this annoying? Rule two, I call 5 or 75. Can a 5-year-old or a 75-year-old figure out how to use whatever you're building?
Yeah. Oh, that's a great rule.
I mean, because some of that's like, you know, that's a good point, because is it simple enough and intuitive enough? And I mean, I think that's the thing that's, you know, I've seen so much software and so many things finally move towards. You know, everything from e-commerce purchases, like how many sales did your e-commerce business miss because you don't have buy as a guest? Because I don't want to fill out another form.
I
don't want to fill out another form. All right. So here we are. We're approaching the landing pad here. I did a couple things. So I give any founder the offer. I like to end my episodes with what I call the founder's freestyle and give you a mic. And you can do whatever you want with it. I got a couple things that I know that I want to point out about that came up today that I thought were pretty impactful. So, but with that, it's your chance to, you can say whatever you want, man. You can, we've had people sing, rap. You might actually take us up on that. Who knows? No. Yeah.
We would need to have been sitting here drinking bourbon this whole time. So.
Maybe.
Yeah.
We are not drinking bourbon here.
No, of course not.
Not yet.
Yeah. So, that man, there are so many things that, that I have come to know, for myself, in the world. And I'll say this, I'll use my time. I think probably a lot of people use this time to pitch their company. DevStride's cool. Maybe, it's yes awesome. No. You should use it.
I mean, a lot of times it's just shit. Yeah. They're like, wow, this went fast. Yeah. I forgot
yeah.
to say
yeah.
this.
Yeah. I was going to say, I want to go a different direction with it. Yeah. So obviously you should use DevStride. If you're an agile dev, please go use DevStride. It's awesome. But actually I think it's much more important to say, if you're a founder and you're out there, your job is hard. You are tired and you are worn out and you've got a million things against you. But I mean, both of us sitting here at this table are proof that if you stick with it and you're nimble and you just are honest with yourself about what's working, what's not working, you keep innovating, like you'll make it to the other side. You just have to like stay with it. Don't let in those dark days, don't like, you know, when you lose a sale you thought you're going to get, or somebody, you know, some employee's mad about something. Don't let that take your eye off the ball. Like it's up to you. Like, you are the heart, you're the soul, you're the thing that keeps the company moving. Like keep your eye on that, be the soul, be the spirit of the company, and just keep driving, drive, always drive, wake up every morning, keep driving. And if there's one thing I tell everybody, just that, just keep at it.
Well, it's amazing you said that, because actually what I had for my freestyle was, so for those of you that aren't aware, I recorded 6 podcasts in 2 days with some of our top Kansas City startups. And so I've been did 3 today. This is the 3rd one. Now, earlier today, I was in here with Toby Rush, who's a very well-known founder here in Kansas City. Great guy. Multiple successful exits. And you used the same word that he used earlier, because he was talking about why it's important to have conviction. Conviction equals passion. And some of that, and that's that keep driving. And that was literally what I wanted to bring in, because I think that you talk about what's your advice or input when you've done it a couple times. Well, you'll see me and the videos we publish online or any of that. If you're not passionate about the business that you're thinking about starting and getting involved with, and Phil's looking at me and shaking his head, because don't do it. Don't yeah, do no. it, because you're going to quit.
Yeah.
You will 100% quit.
It's harder than you think.
You will quit. It's the passion and that conviction. I usually describe it as passion more so than the word conviction, because when I think about conviction, I think about going to jail maybe. But I'm trying to avoid that too. I'm trying to avoid quitting the startup or getting convicted. No, but that passion is that driver, because you really do. I give this advice to so many entrepreneurs. Like, you have to be able to, that's the thing that's going to drive you through the hard moments.
Yeah.
And it is like, it really is a yo-yo. And dude, here's the thing. It doesn't matter if you have a bunch of money in the bank and you're going back and doing it again, because you're going to go through the same thing.
Can I close that off with a personal story?
Yeah, absolutely.
So, you know, I did exit my last company. And one of the things that is kind of cool, and a lot of people don't get to experience this, is I had a 20-year career running a company and doing all the things we just talked about for the last little bit here. And when you go to finally retire and step out, it's in some ways, it's kind of like going to your own funeral. People have an opportunity to tell you all the nice things that they never tell you day to day. And I got to have this really amazing folder in my email inbox that I still save. And I probably got 200 personal messages and stories of just like, you know, we hired people from all over the world out of insane situations, you know, help people go from, you know, I grew up, you know, out in rural Missouri somewhere. And then now I'm, you know, making $250,000 a year as a VP of engineering or whatever, you know, a lot of, and it was just this opportunity to feel amazing about what we had been able to accomplish over the time frame. And so on those hard days, like just having done it, it is so worth it.
Oh yeah.
At the end.
Yeah.
You're changing people's lives.
Oh dude, I've told people about like the misery, and they're like, well, why do you do it? But it's that. And that's the thing is, and you know, the main, so if you look at Startup Hustle, and before we had even published an episode, I made a promo video that was kind of like a slow pan on a lemonade stand and talking about how a lot of us are entrepreneurs. I'm getting goosebumps again.
Yeah.
About entrepreneurs and like, you know, and how we feel that it's what we need to do, but your goal needs to be to build something bigger than you. At least I recommend it. And, you know, that's not always what entrepreneurship looks like for a bunch of people. But with that, the feeling of getting it right and having, it's like, it's almost
it's amazing.
I mean, it really is. And it's, I don't even, it's hard to describe. And the best thing that is a comparison is literally like Maslow's hierarchy of needs. And that fifth little thing is self-actualization.
Yeah, the very tippy top.
What does that actually mean? And that means that you're doing the things that you knew you were always capable of or could. Yeah. And it's a maximization. And that is a very indescribable feeling.
It really is.
I'm sitting here like, what could I describe it as? Like, now I'm going to maybe kill my credibility. Yes, I've tried drugs before. They weren't as good.
No.
They weren't as good. No. That was the best thing.
It's the best thing.
So there's a little open transparency. Yes, being successful as an entrepreneur is way better than drugs. I'm ending this episode on that one. I'm out.
Startup Hustle is brought to you by Fullscale.io. helping you build a software team quickly and affordably. Make sure you reach down and hit that subscribe button, then come find us on Instagram. See you next time. We do it.